This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Sarah Van Gelder has been accused of being too cheerful about the state of the world, an unlikely criticism for someone who has spent a career calling attention to racial, economic, and social injustice. But Sarah focuses on solutions. She co-founded Yes Magazine to showcase people who are taking action to make things better. And more recently, she embarked on a 12,000-mile road trip across the country to meet the folks who are making the change in their own communities. She is now starting a new initiative, the People's Hub, which will empower people across America to take collective action on issues they think are important. Sarah Van Gelder joins us now on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
I want to talk all about Yes Magazine and certainly your 12,000-mile trip and this book that you've written. But I do want you to take us back, because I think for a lot of people familiar with Yes Magazine, it might be nice to know how Sarah Van Gelder got started in all of this. You had a formative experience as a young person traveling to India, right?
That's right. I lived in India for a year when I was just 7 years old. My parents were professors, so we were there on a Fulbright exchange. And for a seven-year-old, it was quite an eye-opener to see that there are people living in other parts of the world who are my own age but didn't have anything like the opportunities that I have. That, in fact, just knowing whether they were going to have enough to eat on a given day was something that was in contention, or whether they'd have a place to sleep. So that was a real eye-opener to me, to realize that people were suffering that way in a way that I just had never been exposed to. And I realized at the time there wasn't anything I could do about it. I was just a kid. But it did make me decide that I was going to spend my life trying to understand what was happening in their lives and what I could do to make a difference.
Did you have a vision for what that moment? You're only 7 years old, but did a vision begin to emerge? What would that look like to a seven-year-old?
Well, what it looked like was that I realized I had privilege because I was able to have a good education. I knew that was in my future. And I didn't know what it would mean in practice. I just knew that it was something I had to keep asking questions about until I could come up with better answers.
Early in your career, you moved to Portland. Why did you make that choice?
I moved to Portland because there was a lot of local activism going on that I found really interesting, a lot of it having to do with cooperatives. And I just felt like, I think a lot of the solutions have to do with changing the way we live where we are and then changing the relationship we have with other countries. Because I think part of what's afflicting places like India is the amount of resources that we in the developed world use. If we could find a simpler and more satisfying way of life in the United States, I thought that could actually benefit those kids that I'd met in India.
You have just said tons and tons and tons right there, so I'm going to unpack it one at a time. Cooperatives, why do you find those so interesting?
Well, cooperatives are an opportunity for people to own their jobs instead of feeling like every day they're in a precarious situation. They have to leave their rights at the door when they go to work. Instead of that, they can actually feel like they're part of making the decisions and they're going to benefit from the decisions that they make. It means that they're having relationships with the other people that they work with that are complicated but are still empowered relationships, where they're not always one down from the boss or from whoever's in charge. I visited on my road trip, maybe I'm skipping ahead here, but I visited one of those co-ops in Chicago, a place where factory workers ended up buying out the factory where they had been working, and they discovered that they could learn how to be their own boss. Yeah. They could acquire the skills to run the factory themselves. And they said, you know what, that meant we weren't spending millions of dollars on executives. We could spread the money among ourselves, and we were also then more competitive because we didn't have to charge the high prices to meet those million-dollar salaries and the Wall Street investment expectations.
Well, yeah, paying out those dividends to people that don't contribute to the work. That's always been a strange thing. But to a factory worker, to someone who has taken over a job, and I want to pursue this now, so it's good that you took us there. If you get into sort of these abstract concepts about ownership and building equity in your work and all of that, that might seem a little abstract. On the other hand, on the day-to-day, sort of the business of once you own the business, what kind of transformation takes place in terms of the understanding of the underlying economics? Is there any of that happens, or is this just a better way to go to work for these guys?
Well, first of all, they understand what the whole business enterprise is about. So they really need to understand the whole system. And then they have a different set of incentives. One of them told me, we used to have ideas for how to improve production, but our bosses weren't that interested in our ideas. And he said, now when we have a good idea, we discuss it, and if it seems to make sense, we just do it. So there's a sense of being able to engage with the process much more deeply. What they hadn't had in the past was an access to all the information about the finances and marketing and so forth. Now they're able to have that information so they can see more deeply what do they need to do to make improvements for the customer as well as for the workers.
And you save a couple of bucks on supervision, too, because now if somebody's malingering and they're with you, it's like, hey, wait a minute, this is my 401k you're messing with. This is my company, and I don't need a bunch of supervisors to crack the whip.
Well, exactly. And people want to please their peers. You know, they want to be accepted and appreciated by their peers. So it becomes part of the culture of the workplace.
So this brings us to the second aspect that you talked about early on, which is this idea of people working together and sort of getting to know each other and having to grapple with problems in common. We don't do much of that. I mean, it's interesting to think that our legal structure, and we'll talk about restorative justice down the line a little bit, but certainly our economic structure doesn't require us to grapple with some of the more difficult issues that are at stake as we develop these businesses.
Well, it's interesting. Our culture has put such a value on individualism that we're sort of taught that if you can just go home and do things by yourself, that's the very best. You have a great big yard with a big fence around it and keep everybody at bay. But the actual research shows that people are now suffering tremendously from loneliness and isolation. The former Surgeon General just came out with a report saying that loneliness is actually as big a health hazard as cigarette smoking. So it
does shorten your life.
It shortens your life, and it shortens the quality of your life.
It shortens the quality of your life.
And it shortens, I think it actually reduces your sense of basic sanity. I think that's one of the things that's going on politically, is we've gotten so unhinged from reality. We just can't tell what's real anymore because all of our news is coming over a little box and a little screen, and a lot of those messages are actually false. They're concocted to be fake news. They're rumors. What we don't have is the chance to really grapple with this, to sit down with our fellow human beings face to face and say, does that sound real to you? Well, no, it doesn't actually. And have those kinds of conversations that help ground us in reality.
In your trip across the country, and we're going to talk about a few more examples and some of the people that you met, but just generally, did you find people are noticing in that? In other words, have they identified that as one of the problems that we need to tackle in this country?
You know, I don't know how many people think of it in a conscious way that way, but I think you can see the kinds of implications of that. I just heard from a professor who said that his students, when he asked them what kind of communications they were interested in, almost none of them were interested in online communications. They said, we got plenty of that already. We really want to learn how to do the face-to-face stuff.
Wow. I wonder if there's a place where you can go to learn that, how to talk face-to-face to people. There's probably an institute for that, and I'm sure there's an online course. I want to take you back, though, a little bit, because you talked about going to Portland, getting engaged. You found that there was a lot of community activity there. And then the first time you really tried to make change as a citizen, in fact, you moved to an Indian reservation outside of Seattle and find yourself in the middle of a conflict there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I didn't move there in order to be an activist. I just happened to move there because I found a house that I could afford and liked the location. And so I moved in, and then fairly soon after learned that my neighbors were organizing to keep the tribe from building housing for their own members in, quote, our neighborhood. Excuse me, I have a little cold.
It's very good of you to come on and do all this talking with your cold, so I appreciate that.
So one of the first things I did was go to this local meeting that they called to confront the county commission and try to keep the tribe from building this housing, and discovered one after another people were just getting up and berating the tribe and saying, we don't want those people in our neighborhood. And finally I had to speak up and say, you know, I just think, of course, they have the right to build housing in their neighborhood. So I hadn't really planned to move in as an activist, and then I sort of found myself, well, if I don't, then I'm sort of implicated in this. An elder followed me out after I spoke and said, you know, thank you for speaking and really appreciate it, but we've actually got a really good legal department. And turns out when they did build the housing, they named the street that goes to the housing We One Way. So they did it.
Not exactly Mount Rushmore, but a stick in the eye anyway, I guess. It's one way to sort of get back at that. What was your takeaway at that point? Because, again, you want to learn more, so you go to places like Portland. Then you find yourself embroiled and say, well, gee, I've got to actually do something. I've got to stop thinking about it. There you are, embroiled in this. When did the idea for Yes Magazine arise?
Well, I'd actually been editing another magazine called In Context Magazine, and the founders decided to close it. So a group of us had to say, you know, are we going to go home or are we going to spin it off? And so we decided that we felt like we had things that we wanted to say, and there was a lot of reporting left to be done, and so we spun it off. And that was 20 years ago, and we haven't looked back.
What was the philosophy as you talked about spinning off that magazine?
Well, a lot of people back then and still today are doing a great job of examining the problems in our society. But we were really interested in the solutions, and not just a simple kind of facile, you know, here's a problem, here's a solution, but something that goes deeper to say, what kind of society do we really want to build together? Because we don't have to live in a society where the economy is systematically funneling all the money up to the 0.1%. We don't have to live in a society where we're destroying the life support systems of the planet. You know, we don't have to live in a society where racism is so pervasive. So we were really interested in what are people doing to create a different kind of society?
Do they do that? I mean, I wonder, you know, getting back to some of the things you've said, and I'm thinking about even the protest in that neighborhood to stop Native Americans from building housing in their community. I'm guessing that a lot of the people who were at that county commission, you know, giving testimony and saying stop the Indians from building, had never been involved in politics and never see themselves in building a better world. It's just that was the issue in their neighborhood. They got active. And so I guess my question to you is, do we think in terms of building a better world? Does anybody think about a system that would make things better? And can we even engage the problem or any of the problems from that level, from that view?
You know, I think you're right. I think people don't think in those kinds of abstractions. They think in terms of the community where they live. So one of the things that we did in Suquamish, in this community, is in the midst of some of these battles where we were on the one side supporting the tribe, the organization I helped start, was supporting the tribe, and other people were denigrating them and showing up in all sorts of public spaces and saying how horrible they were. One of the things we did is we had a session called Imagine Suquamish, which brought everybody together to ask the question, what kind of community would you really like? And it turned out a lot of people had a lot of similar ideas, and they got to hear directly from each other about those similar ideas, like sidewalks for the kids.
What were you able to bring people together? Because I have noticed that in those efforts that try to bring people from all sides together, not all sides show up. One side tends to show up, and the other side tends to stay home. Were you actually able to bring protesters together with natives and say, look, let's talk this thing over face to face?
We didn't. We weren't the ones to hold the gathering. Right. It was the county commission. And I think that helped.
And through that medium and through that. You've co-founded Yes Magazine in every quarter. As you say, it's in its 21st year now, I think. 20 years that magazine has been going. Every quarter, the magazine addresses a new theme. How do you choose those themes?
Well, I should say I'm not at Yes Magazine anymore. I'm on to a new project. But the way we would choose them is by looking at what's going on in our society right now that's especially urgent. And where are there opportunities to break through? So we would be looking for where are there a number of people actually working to make something different and base the theme on that.
You and again, as you go around, I want to sort of focus on this question of what problem people think they're solving. Have you found that in most cases the problem just became so difficult, if it's in the case of starting a co-op or restorative justice or whatever theme that you've taken on, people tackle the problem in their neighborhood without much regard to sort of the bigger question or whether this could be scaled up and solve some of the more thorny issues at the national or international stage?
I think it does both. Because I think people start understanding the connection of where they live to those issues. And I think it builds optimism because I think people feel very hopeless right now.
You did a project, your work. I want to talk with you about your work on something you call sustainable happiness. And that is a theme that all of us would appreciate. So please do tell us more.
Okay. So this book that we edited at Yes Magazine is about how we have been sold a bill of goods about happiness coming from what we have, or the status that is related to consumerism, instead of the real authentic sources of happiness, which our grandmother told us about. Things like counting your blessings, gratitude. Things like having work that has meaning. Not necessarily work with status, but work with meaning. Things like contributing to your community. So those are the kinds of things that we write about in this book.
I'm going to let you – I want to know more about that, because, again, I think this comes right back to that theme, whether or not people notice that that's the source of their unhappiness. I mean, the tragedy of this addiction to consumption is what I call the Homer Simpson effect. He's plugging in the plug, shocking himself, and over, it's do, shock. And I get the feeling that this is what happens every time we go up on Amazon or any other online, you know, when we make a purchase. There's this momentary sense of, the new thing is going to come, and that's going to make my coffee taste better in the morning. And then the new thing comes, and your coffee's the same, but you keep buying the new thing. The simple truth that your life is not getting any better doesn't seem to crash in on anybody. They keep, you know, drinking the same drink over and over again and waking up with the same hangover. What do you think is responsible for that?
Well, the billions of dollars spent on advertising is one thing. We're being told that over and over again. And there isn't the same amount of money being put into the grandmother's advice.
That's right. One pot of chicken soup was enough to prove the truth of your grandmother's bromide, and yet the soup pot is empty. You also edited a book on the Occupy movement, and that again is something that a lot of people consider a failure. They like to move on. You don't consider it a failure.
That's right. I think that. That at the time that the Occupy movement came about, most of the political conversation had been about things like the budget deficit. People were ignoring this huge and growing wealth inequality and income inequality. And yet people were suffering from, especially from debt. And debt was something that a lot of people experienced as shameful. They felt like it was shameful that they graduated from college with huge student loans, or shameful that they had a medical emergency and had to go into debt to save somebody's life. And Occupy helped to switch that, helped to say, no, that's not your shame. That's our society's shame, that we have structured things so that ordinary life becomes such a financial burden.
The way wealth and particularly ownership, going back to co-ops, the way it's structured, this structure will necessarily funnel lots of money from the lower and middle classes to that one and less than 1%.
Exactly.
And that's the source of a lot of the pain and the resentment that we've seen reflected in our political system on the right and on the left. And if the system has failed you and you're an unemployed worker somewhere in the middle of Ohio, you may not have many other explanations, but the fact is there is this systemic. Do you think that conversation is still happening, though, or was it
absolutely.
Yeah?
I think it helped to catapult the Bernie Sanders campaign. It was central to his campaign. And I think it's become part of the basic awareness of people's lives. I think the fact that people are in debt is no longer quite that same source of shame. In fact, there is a wonderful movement that came out of Occupy called the Debt Jubilee, where some people discovered that the debt collection agencies actually go out and buy debt for pennies on the dollar. So they went online and collect and raised a bunch of money and started using it to just randomly relieve people's debt. So they were able to do it for pennies on the dollar, just like a collection agency.
Well, I want to find out more about your take on where we're headed and your 12,000-mile trek across the country as we meet Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder of Yes Magazine, author of The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through New America. She's going to be speaking tonight, if we give her voice a rest, at the Eno River Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. That's tonight at 7. We've got the info at our website, and our conversation continues on the state of things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, and I'm talking to Sarah Van Gelder, who has always been passionate about making the world more just. She co-founded Yes Magazine in 1996. She is the author of The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through New America. She's going to be at the Eno River Unitarian Universalist Fellowship tonight in Durham. And for we're coming up on 20 years at the magazine. Sarah did notice that things weren't actually getting getting much better, even though they were reporting on solutions all across the country. And she wondered if she was talking to the right people in the right places. And so that is what led her to buy a used pickup truck and a camper and set off on the road for that 12,000-mile journey. Tell us more about that decision to make that trip.
Yeah, so like a lot of people, I tend to stay close to home or to go to, like a lot of people on the coast, I tend to go to the other coast when I go anywhere. And I thought, you know, it's time for me to really go to other parts of this country. This was 2015. The election campaign wasn't really on the horizon yet. I just felt like, you know, if there's anybody who might be at the forefront of change, it may be the people that are less embedded, less rewarded by the status quo. So I went to a lot of Indian reservations. I went to a bunch of cities in the Rust Belt. I went to Appalachia, came here to North Carolina, and I talked to some amazing people, and it really did give me hope.
Well, let's talk about that trip to North Carolina, Greensboro in particular. Tell us about that visit to Greensboro.
Yeah, so I came here. I came to Greensboro in part because of the original sit-in in 1960 at the lunch counter, but more so because of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission there. That's a restorative justice and truth and reconciliation. Those have been things I've been tracking because it seems like we have such a desperate need to grapple with wrongdoing, whether it's at the scale of our entire society, like in South Africa around apartheid, like in the United States around our history of racial injustice and treatment of indigenous people, and by the way, happy Indigenous Peoples Day. So truth and reconciliation seems like it's one of those ideas that has some potential for actually allowing
us to... Well, tell us about that, forgive me for interrupting, but the Truth and Reconciliation Commission followed the KKK killings, the violence that surrounded a demonstration in Greensboro in the 1970s. There was controversy around that event, and it had never been satisfactorily explained. There was an impetus from the community, particularly in the African-American community, to start a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They did, but the city never signed on.
Worse than that, I think the city actually opposed it. So they did it anyway. And that's one of the things I love about citizen activism is people don't wait for permission. They just say, you know what, we'd love to have you join in, but if you won't, we're going to do it anyway. So they held hearings. They had they brought the people who were willing to talk and just asked them to tell their stories. And they put together a report about what happened and the outcome. I think there was actually a lot of people who were opposed to it, not only from the city council, but even on the African-American community side, because people didn't want to stir things up. But there is a sense that, no, you really have to come around to not calling it like President Trump did in terms of Charleston, not calling it some kind of equivalency of both sides were to blame, really getting clear that certain people brought weapons and certain people died.
And that there was police complicity in all of this, that the police knew that this was going to happen, stayed away when they knew the Klan was going to be armed. Yeah, and then the false equivalence. But is it a Truth and Reconciliation Commission if only one side plays the game? Isn't part of this that has to be buy-in on all sides in order for it to be a true reconciliation?
Absolutely. That's the ideal, is that everybody's at the table. But you do what you can, and you invite everybody, and you do what you can. And, you know, here we have a situation where it was this sort of marginalized approach. And yet in August, the Greensboro City Council voted to apologize. And they did so citing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report as one of the reasons they did that. Obviously, that didn't get in my book because it had just happened a couple months ago.
One of the men behind this getting the Truth and Reconciliation Commission going was a man named Ed Whitfield, who is a longtime community organizer. Tell us a little bit more about his story and how he plays into the larger narrative that you found traveling the country.
Yeah, he's a fascinating person. He went to Cornell and could have – actually, he was one of the first people to desegregate the Little Rock High School not in the very first class, but in one of the first classes, and did so because he felt he had a point to make, not because he was very clear to me when I interviewed him, not because he felt like the education in the white school was going to be any better. He felt like in the African-American school, he'd actually have teachers who cared enough about him to really work with him. So it was more of making a statement. And then went to Cornell University and decided not to go for a national kind of career, but to go to a place where he would put down roots and really make a difference where he lives. And I just found his way of thinking about social change really fascinating.
He has worked very hard to get a cooperative grocery store opened in a food desert in Greensboro as well, a conventional cooperative grocery store.
That's right. And when I was there, I interviewed some of the people who are involved in that. And I love that they, instead of talking about people as members, each of the members were referred to as an owner. Because especially in the African-American community, it's so hard to find anything you can actually own. Ownership is so elusive. So each member of that co-op is an owner.
Restorative justice is something that you talk about in the book as well. Talk about the restorative justice projects that you uncovered on your journey.
So I went to Harrisonburg, Virginia, which is where a lot of the great thinking about restorative justice happens, but it's also where the police department's gotten very involved. And I interviewed one of the lieutenants in the police department about why they were doing that. And he said, you know, with the Black Lives Matter protests and so forth, there's really an increasing questioning of the legitimacy of the police departments, because they're seen not necessarily as being in the service of the public. They're seen by a number of communities as being more like an occupying force. So if the police department wants to be an effective crime fighter, they have to have legitimacy.
Tell us how restorative justice works.
So what they'll do is in certain cases, and certainly not all cases are eligible, but in certain cases they will actually, instead of going through the court system, they'll actually work to bring together the people who are involved in a crime on the victim side and on the perpetrator side, and look for ways that people can meet and find a better outcome than simply putting somebody in prison. Yeah. You know, so many crimes are really small crimes. They're not about people who are going to be violent or going to be, you know, terrorize a community. One example that he gave me was about a woman who had embezzled from her church, and the pastor didn't want her to go to prison. He didn't want that kind of an outcome, but he didn't want to just ignore it either. So many crimes are of that nature, and if they can be dealt with in that kind of restorative manner where somebody can make restitution and put everything right, the community is much stronger as a result.
And I think this is something people don't understand, but restorative justice is seen as a victim's advocacy procedure. It allows the victim, because in our current penal system, the victim is completely taken out of the equation. It is the state versus perpetrator, and you get to sit on the sidelines and watch the whole thing unfold. How you feel about it, how you felt about it, how it affected your community, perhaps this theft, is no part of the discussion. The state has taken your grief and decided the fate. And so, and I don't know how it worked there, but in many places, this is something that victims say they've long waited for, and for them, this restorative justice is a great relief.
That's right. There's actually evidence that there's less long-term trauma in those kinds of cases than where somebody just is, as you say, excluded from the process and then just can watch from the sideline. They don't have any agency or any say in what happens.
So tell us how it's working out in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
Well, when I was there, they were just starting it, so that has yet to be seen, so I can't really tell you.
So one of the things that you're starting now is the People's Hub, and I want to know more about this because, again, it gets at this idea that people need to be face-to-face grappling with these things, where the victim and the perpetrator need to be in the same room, where workers are owning the business and building equity in their own business and having fights about where the money should go among themselves, not with shareholders far, far away. Tell us how the People's Hub plays into this idea that we need to get together and look each other in the eye.
Yeah, so the idea, it actually came out of this road trip. The idea is that in our communities, we have the best chance to find our power and to get stuff done. So instead of feeling powerless, if we just meet with two or three other or four other people and say we all care about the same thing, we can get stuff done. And if we work on that together and are willing to really hear each other, really hear the diverse voices in our own community, our own sense of who the we is that we care about expands. We can actually have that kind of experience of empathy so that we actually can understand the world in a broader way.
I can understand that might happen when people are in the same room. What brings them to the same room? Why would I go to a place where I'm going to see people I don't agree with?
Well, you may not start there. You may start with people you do agree with. But if you start in the same room and start doing stuff together, you're going to encounter some of those folks. And PeopleSub is not going to be in the business of trying to start all these little organizations all over the country. We can't do that. What we want to do is help the ones that are starting or people who do. As for example, after the election, a lot of people said, I realize I can no longer outsource my activism. I have to get involved. And so they want to get involved in their communities, but it's not so simple. People go into a meeting and it's a terrible meeting and everybody has a terrible time, or they get into a conflict and they don't know how to navigate it. So what we want to do is offer them skills so they can do those things well.
All right, so you are starting with an army of the willing. These are the people who have noticed that their activism has become become perhaps ineffectual and impersonal. Is there enough? Is there a critical mass, or have we been utterly defanged? I mean, if you think about the way consumerism works, it has the effect, intended or not, of allowing us to express our choice in a commercial marketplace, which may distract us from making a choice in a political marketplace. That is to say, have we lost the instinct for this kind of political engagement, and is it too late?
I don't think it's too late. I mean, there may be a certain number of people who are going to spend all their time watching television. There's nothing you can do about that. But there are a lot of people who really want to get out and really want to be around other people. They want to get stuff done. And they especially want to do stuff that doesn't necessarily start out really contentious and really scary. So it can be something as simple as, you know, have a potluck every month and talk about, you know, what you love about your community. It's one of the things we did in Suquamish is we have a potluck every year where we lift up the heroes in our community who are bringing us together. So there's a political side to it because we're saying we care about the people who are showing us how to get along with people who are different. But it's a celebration.
I wonder if this is like a kind of an addiction program, though, where people have to kind of hit bottom before they realize that this is the remedy. In other words, and maybe a more concrete way to look at it, given your experience traveling the country, do you find the most creative solutions in the places that have been neglected for so long that no one else, that they are the only ones who can take control of their situation?
I think that happens sometimes, but we also see people using opioids to
self-medicating, right?
Exactly. So I don't think it's necessarily the people at the very bottom. I think it often is people who have some sense of connection, some sense of hope. But then they can bring in the other people. They can bring in their brother-in-law or, you know, the neighbor or somebody who's really lost hope and say, you know what, just come with us. Let's see what we can make happen together. And just the experience of people coming out of their homes and doing things together. I was really struck on my road trip how often when I saw people doing that, there was just this joy and relief. People were so happy to be out doing stuff with other people.
You have been, and I've read criticisms that say you're just too optimistic, you're too sunny about all of this, and you're not paying attention to how things have really gone to hell. What's your response to that?
Well, I am really concerned about where we are. I think there's all sorts of trends that are very frightening. And I don't feel like I can predict what will happen, but what I can choose is what I want to give my energy to. And I choose to give my energy to where I see solutions that are real, where I see the possibilities for a new kind of society. And I see those possibilities all over the place. So that's what I want to do with People's Hub, is support the people all over the country who are making that choice where they live to make it a better world right there. And anything I can do to accompany them, offer them coaching, not for me, I'm not going to be the coach, but the person, if they have a particular quandary they're trying to work on, I'm going to try to find them the coach that can help accompany them as they work their way through that.
We picked some of the solutions and some of the stories that most appeal to us from your book. What were some of the most striking stories that you came across for you?
Oh, I was really interested in the women in the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Reservation, North Dakota, who discovered that fracking was on its way to their community, did some research, and then convinced the whole community to ban fracking. So fracking is now not allowed on the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Reservation. And when I talked to the tribal chairman about it, he said, you know, I've discovered this thing that money doesn't buy happiness. And what he was talking about was looking at what was happening in the places where oil and gas booms were bringing in crime and bringing in human trafficking and huge pollution problems. He said, you know, I'm used to making money the old-fashioned way. I earn it. So he has a small business. He he's fine with that, even though that means millions of dollars that the tribe could have gotten from the fracking boom. So that's one of my favorite stories.
A rare circumstance where reason prevailed, where the facts, I mean, whether or not, however you feel about fracking, it was the facts that persuaded people in that place, and a sense that money won't bring you happiness, which is another rare find. So happy you found it and brought it to our attention. Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder of Yes Magazine, the author of The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile journey through a new America. Sarah Van Gelder will be speaking at the Eno River Unitarian Universalist Fellowship tonight at 7 o'clock. We have that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Sarah, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you so much, Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.